I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and welcome to The Jackpod, where On Point news analyst Jack Beattie helps us connect history, literature, and politics in a way that brings truly unique clarity to the world we live in now. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Meghna.
Okay, so today we are at episode 11. Tell us what your headline is, Jack.
The F word.
Now, the first time you told me this, Jack, I'll admit, I laughed, but then you told me what you wanted to talk about, and it's far more sobering. So what do you mean?
What I mean is Donald Trump's increasing use of fascist and Nazi imagery in his speeches.
Okay. Wow. Well, we actually have one example here that you pointed us to, and it happened over the weekend at a Veterans Day speech in Claremont, New Hampshire. And here is what Trump said.
We will root out the communists, Marxists, fascists, and the radical left thugs that live like vermin within the confines of our country.
You know, Jack, even after many years of hearing Donald Trump's increasingly extreme rhetoric, hearing him say something like that on a Veterans Day speech of all times and places, it's something else.
It is. Vermin, you know, he might have dredged that image up from the deep well of his indecency, or he might have read it, along with the similar comment he made a week ago that immigrants were poisoning the blood of the country. He might have read that from a book. His first wife said he kept by his bedside, a copy of Hitler's speeches.
Mm. Now, we should note, as of course you know, Jack, that both Hitler and Mussolini at various times used rodent language to severely denigrate those who opposed them. But at the same time, Jack, in the United States over the past 5 or 6 years, no matter how extreme Trump's rhetoric has become, very few people have been willing to cross the line and say, no, this is fascist. But you're saying now it's the time to do so, and in fact, some well-respected historians and other analysts have?
Yes, too notably. And remember, for historians to enter into present-day political argument is sort of against one of the canons of academic history. It's a violation of what they call presentism. They feel they have no authority over the present. So when they speak to the present, they've overcome some professional inhibitions. Two such people have done that recently, Robert O. Paxton and Christopher Browning. Both of them are now clear that the label fascist should be worn indelibly by Donald Trump. Paxton is the Mellon Professor Emeritus at the Department of History at Columbia. His work on Vichy France and the Jews in the 1970s essentially restored to the French the true history of the Vichy experience and documented the eagerness with which the Vichy authorities cooperated with the Nazis in exporting 70,000 Jews to their death. It was a major scandal in France, and really opened up a whole new terrain of truth that the French had tried to repress and keep out of mind. For our purposes, he's also the author of a classic book, The Anatomy of Fascism. He is one of the world's authorities, and here's what he says. I resisted for a long time applying the fascist label to Donald J. Trump. Trump's incitement of the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th, removes my objection to the fascist label. His open encouragement of civic violence to overturn an election crosses a red line. The label fascist seems not just acceptable, but necessary for Donald Trump.
Mm. Now, Jack, we're living in a time where people use very strong terms rather freely. So in order to understand the depth of Paxton's sort of almost lament here, how does he define fascism?
Well, in The Anatomy of Fascism, he says that fascism embodies a series of what he calls mobilizing passions. One, an overwhelming crisis that can't be solved by traditional methods. What did Trump say at this convention? I alone can solve it. Two, subordination of the individual to the group and the maintenance of group purity. Trump, with all his talk about rhinos and people who don't have, who aren't with him, are against him, and they're outside the group. Three, the group sees itself as a victim. And of course, everything Trump says is about this grievance, victim. They're out to get you, and so on. Four, the need for the authority of a natural chief whose qualities rise above abstract reason. That's Trump. No one could ever accuse him of having reason, abstract or otherwise, just the sense that he is the chieftain of this cult. And five, and most frighteningly, the use of exclusionary violence to reverse perceived decline. Trump has recently come out with a sort of agenda for his second term that, you know, includes forcibly rounding up millions of undocumented immigrants, putting others in internment camps, turning the Justice Department into a department of persecution against his enemies. And when this was challenged and people said, oh, no, he wouldn't do anything as bad as that, and it's wrong to call him fascist, one of Trump's people said, oh, wait for that second term. He will crush the existence of people who say that. So he's not hiding what's in store for us if he wins.
Well, and that preview, essentially, that Trump has already given us, if he wins the White House again, that is one of the reasons that another scholar that you respect quite deeply has said it's time to call Trump what he is.
This is Christopher Browning, again, an eminent historian of the Holocaust and, incidentally, the author of a classic book, Ordinary Men, about the Einsatzgruppen, the very people that Benjamin Ferenc, we had him quoted him on our show the other day. He I think he's passed away since, but he was then 100-odd years old, and he was reflecting on his experience as the prosecutor at Nuremberg of the leader of Einsatzgruppen. These were the sort of pioneers of the Holocaust. And in Ordinary Men, Browning does a depiction of a battalion of them and how they went from being butchers and bakers and candlestick makers into mass murderers, a great and frightening book. Anyway, he has himself come out now and said, Trump is a fascist. He said, I've resisted, just like Paxton, I've resisted using the word until now, but something novel and menacing is taking shape with the possibility of a second Trump term. He says, unlike previous fascist leaders with their cult of war, Trump still offers appeasement to dictators abroad. But he has promised something much closer to dictatorship at home. For me, what Trump is offering in his second term meets the threshold for the label I'd use to describe him. What he's promising is isolationist fascism, not fascism going out conquering the world, just going after his enemies here at home.
Oh, that is so chilling and interesting, the concept of isolationist fascism. Now, Jack, it's not by accident that we have two historians here who you're presenting to us, and particularly one who's a scholar of the Holocaust, who have come to this moment where they see Trump as having passed beyond the pale, right? Because I'm going back and thinking about that tape we heard of what Trump said in New Hampshire, again, on a Veterans Day weekend and in a Veterans Day talk or speech. And that use of the word vermin, I want to come back to it again briefly, Jack, because it's not just that, oh, Mussolini and Hitler used that language too. It's that it was effective, right? And so effective that You wanted to also point out that Art Spiegelman's historic and prize-winning book, Mouse, that's why, one of the reasons why the characters are all rendered as rodents.
Yes, and Spiegelman, in an interview, said this. I began to read what I could about the Nazi genocide. The most shocking and revealing anti-Semitic work I found was The Eternal Jew, a 1940 German, quote, documentary that portrayed Jews in a ghetto swarming with bearded caftan creatures, and then cut to Jews as mites, or rather rats, swarming in a little circle that said, Jews are the rats, the vermin of mankind. This bit of Nazi filmmaking made it clear to me that this dehumanization was at the very heart of the killing project. Mm. In fact, Zyklon B, the gas used in Auschwitz as the killing agent, was a pesticide manufactured to kill vermin.
Mm. Mm. You know, when you told me a few days ago, Jack, that this was the really challenging idea you wanted to bring to this episode of the Jackpod, it suddenly triggered in my brain a memory of Philip Roth's 2004 book, The Plot Against America. Do you recall that book? It's where Roth wrote basically a fictionalized account of a 1930s election and portraying Charles Lindbergh as having won against FDR. And, of course, Lindbergh being extremely far right, Philip Roth talks about how, or he tells a story of life under fascism in America in the 30s. And I just went back and thumbed through the book, and there's this quote here where he says, where Roth writes, "To have enslaved America with this hocus pocus, to have captured the mind of the world's greatest nation without uttering a single word of truth, oh, the pleasure we must be affording the most malevolent man on earth." I mean, are we really that close to that, Jack? Because, sorry, I'm pausing here to think, because as I said earlier, very, very few people until now, some, but hardly any, have been willing to say what we're seeing now is nascent fascism. I mean, maybe because Trump hasn't overtly said, given forward a plan for global domination or mass extermination. I mean, aren't those justifiable objections to bringing the idea of fascism and Trump together?
Yes, and those are objections that have inhibited historians from commenting. Some have said to bring Trump into this ambit of this word with its malevolent, as you say, uniquely malevolent overtones, is to trivialize the Holocaust. But Christopher Browning and Robert Paxton are not journalists. They are not commentators. They are not, you know, people on MSNBC. They have put their professional reputations behind the word. And therefore, it has to carry weight with anyone who believes there's something to be learned from history.
Mm. Okay. Well, Jack, invoking history isn't just an intellectual exercise, right? I mean, you have personal connections to the very period of world history that we're speaking about, in which the most, you know, horrific versions of fascism humanity has experienced have come from.
Yes, I have my roll of honor of men who, when fascism was a dark and bloody reality, were fighting it. And I want to argue that the word fascist should be used in preference to authoritarian. Authoritarian is a political science term, an abstract term. Fascism is soaked with the blood of the 20th century. And I think it's more appropriate and viscerally compelling. And my illustration of men who fought and some who died fighting fascism begins with my cousin, Charlie O'Connor, one of 11 children born to Mame and Ed O'Connor in Dorchester, Massachusetts, who was raised to honor his parents, participate in the life of his church, and to and to have great pride in his country. Charlie volunteered for the army, and along with 20,000 other Americans, was killed in the snows of Belgium during the Battle of the Bulge. Charlie O'Connor died fighting fascism. A second veteran who fought fascism, Joe O'Connell. He was a colleague of mine at the Atlantic Monthly. He had a severely, to see him, he sort of dragged his side with him, kind of walked with one foot. And you know what? In the way we all do, you look at someone like that and you think, oh gosh, you just look away. You think, what an affliction. And but what one should have said is one should have stopped where one was and saluted him. Joe O'Connell was in a unit that fought the fascists for 600 days, the longest of any group in the army, from North Africa to Sicily, up the Italian boot, and near Monte Cassino. Joe O'Connell was hit by a grenade and never walked right again, and he couldn't bend over without... Anyway, he saved our world, he and men like him, and he bore the scars of it. And when I think of any possibility of reviving fascism or anything, even in a dilute version, it's as if you throw the sacrifice of men like that away and say, we don't care, we don't need you, prices are too high, Biden is too old, let's have Trump. God help us.
Okay, folks, so this is the time where I always ask you what you think. Do you agree with Jack and think it's time to call Trump and Trumpism the equivalent of isolationist fascism in this country? Or do you find the idea completely ludicrous? No matter what you think, let us know and let us know why. So you can do that via going to the On Point Vox Pop app. Hopefully you already have it. If you don't, just go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop and send us your thoughts there. Now, we do read every, actually not read, we hear every single one of the messages that you send to us for the Jack Pod. And they are always thoughtful and always provocative. So, Jack, we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll hear what folks thought of last week's Jack Pod. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Okay, Jack, we are back. And again, your theme for this week's podcast is fascism, which is really interesting because before our break there, you said that it gives you extreme pause and pain when people say that, you know, their prices are too high, Joe Biden's too old, it doesn't really matter who you vote for. Well, that's actually very fascinating because surprisingly, we got a call almost exactly along those lines. And here it is.
I don't like Biden. He's too old. Although I will vote for Biden only because if Trump would win, I can't leave the country.
Okay, so there's a listener who said, yeah, Biden's too old, but he sees Trump as a bigger threat rather than Biden's octogenarianism. But anyway, that message came in because the Jack Pod last week, you talked about New Hampshire and the New Hampshire primary's ability to kneecap, let's put it that way, incumbent presidents. So here's Alex Ross from Brooklyn, New York, and he wanted to tell you this about the current primary field.
When Jack and Meghna set out to discuss the New Hampshire Democratic primary, Jack asserted that Biden had only one opponent, Dean Phillips. As of today, Marianne Williamson is the only candidate on the New Hampshire ballot. Biden's not on it, and neither is Phillips. who trails Matt Marianne in the polls. So please explain to me how you can have a reasonable and informed discussion of a primary race and fail to even mention an upper-tier candidate who is the only one appearing on the ballot for that state.
Now, Jack, I will say that as a rule, I like to discuss all candidates, no matter how far-fetched their chances at winning may be. Also, factually, Marianne Williamson's campaign went nowhere in the last presidential election, which maybe doesn't makes it forgivable that she wasn't the focus of last week's jackpot. But what's your explanation to Alex?
Well, first of all, he's incorrect. I mean, he spoke before the New Hampshire ballot was issued. Mm-hmm. The primary is going to be on the 23rd of January, earlier by a week of Biden's new beginning, which would be South Carolina. And Dean Phillips and Marianne Williamson and 18 other people are on that ballot. Joe Biden is not, and there's a move to write him in, and led by leading Democrats. On the other hand, other Democrats say, wait a minute, if we write him in and Dean Phillips wins the vote by, a substantial amount, there's going to be immense pressure for Joe Biden to pull out, as there was for Harry Truman in 1952. And Lyndon Johnson in 1968. So we don't know how that's going to play out, but Dean Phillips is definitely on the ballot.
And you said 18 other people too, Jack. And I feel that I've backed myself into a corner when I said that I believe in talking about all candidates equally. Wow. Okay. Well, let's move on to another one of your listeners who tells us, by the way, that he was listening to last week's jackpot while making pancakes on a Sunday morning in Tokyo. So the jackpot is global. This is Daniel Heller, and he has this idea.
I would like to see Joe Biden resign the presidency, make Kamala Harris president, make her, the incumbent. And then let's see what happens. I have a feeling that she is the one who could lead the country. She's a new generation. She has the ability. She has the support of many people who would vote for her, and the Democrats would win.
What do you think of Daniel's alternative idea here?
Well, it's interesting. The reporting about whether Biden would run or not late last year kept talking about something called the Harris problem. That if Biden didn't run, Harris would be the nominee, and the feeling within the Democratic Party was that she would lose. Why would she lose? Well, Stacey Abrams, the Georgia political activist, spoke to this a couple of weeks ago on television, and she said, misogyny and racism, that's what has given Kamala Harris the worst rating of any vice president, worst popularity since this began to be measured in the 80s, which means worse than Dan Quayle. Mm. And she says it's misogyny and it's racism. Well, undoubtedly, those forces are at work. But it has to also be said she has not distinguished herself, and she has continually seemed to not be able to get her verbal footing and to show any kind of political finesse. However, if she is the nominee, what Stacey Abrams said about her popularity goes in spades when she's running against Donald J. Trump, who's a specialist in polarizing around misogyny, witness Hillary Clinton, and racism, witness practically everything he ever said about Barack Obama. So it would be an immense risk for the Democratic Party to have her as the nominee.
Mm. Okay, so there was a lot of feedback that we got about just the primary calendar as it is and the caucuses calendar as it is. For example, here's Kevin Queen from Omaha, Nebraska.
By the time our primary season, Election Day, comes around, it's more of a formality. Just across the river, 10 minutes away from where I live, is Iowa. And they're one of the first people that get to vote. And I just hate that how someone does in an early primary can dictate whether or not they are even going to be on the ballot when it becomes my turn to vote.
Okay, so that was Kevin from Omaha, Nebraska. Then we heard, as we do every week, from Howard Turner in Elkhart, Indiana. And Howard very modestly said maybe he's not the voice from Elkhart or the view from Elkhart, as I wanted to call him, because he knows many, many people living in his community that see the world very differently from him. And by the way, Howard, do us a favor. Go talk to, or if you have neighbors that have those different points of views, tell them to listen to the Jackpot and send us their thoughts. Now, Howard sent us an idea for how the primary season should be run, and he says he even sent a letter to the Democratic, the DNC, urging them to adopt his plan.
Dividing the states up into groups of around seven states each, from a, with a state or two from each geographic area. Each area or each group would vote on the same primary day, and then you just next month, then the group two votes, and so on down. Each cycle you rotate around, so one group isn't always going first.
Okay, so that innovative idea from Elkhart, Indiana. One more here, Jack. This is James Utt from Minneapolis, Minnesota. James is very skeptical that New Hampshire will change anything about the lay of the land in 2024.
I'm not at all confident that the restructured Democratic primary in New Hampshire in 2024 will have the capacity, let alone the likelihood, of drawing an important distinction to the fore and causing President Biden to realize that he may very well be a far weakened candidate for re-election than what he envisioned even several months ago.
Okay, Jack, I think James is saying there that Biden won't realize that he's a weaker candidate. What did you hear in what he said?
Yeah, I think he was saying that whatever the decision, it isn't going to affect him the way it did LBJ.
Yeah.
You know, where basically that was the coup de grace on Johnson's hesitancy. He just had to once Gene McCarthy made a strong showing against him, and something similar with Harry Truman in 1952. I think James is saying that's not going to happen this year. And it's entirely possible that it won't happen.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's funny because I'm glad James sent us that message, because I'd forgotten to ask you something. When we did last week's Jackpot, I wanted to ask you, to put it bluntly, who really cares about New Hampshire? No, I'm serious, because you mentioned that Biden, of course, isn't giving the New Hampshire primary much thought at all. But maybe that's not the mistake that it seems to be, right? Because as you were pointing out, America 2023 or 2024 is very, very different from the America of the 1960s. So, you know, on the Democratic side, it does make sense to focus on places like South Carolina, Nevada, and they may be actually more telling than New Hampshire. What do you think, Jack?
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's one of the arguments that Biden used to promote South Carolina, that the base of the Democratic Party are African American voters. They are in South Carolina in numbers, and in Nevada, of course, you've got Hispanic voters. That's what the Democratic Party is, they should have the saying. Whereas New Hampshire, I think, is 96% white. So it's not a representative state for the Democratic Party in any way. It is more representative in its demographics of the Republican Party than it is of the Democrat.
Mm. Well, every time I go up there to hike in the White Mountains, I am proud to make New Hampshire 95.9999% white. Oh, sorry, New Hampshire. I love you. You know I do. Okay, here's the last one. Now, this is James again from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and his greatest concern, even though he thinks New Hampshire won't change anything, is that a Joe Biden candidacy, actually to bring us back to today's theme, Jack, it could lead to a second term for former President Donald Trump.
I'm so worried that the Democratic Party, especially under President Biden's intransigence, is running a gigantic risk of failing at the most critically important time in any modern electoral cycle.
What do you think, Jack?
The stakes are so high. Dean Phillips, the Minnesota congressman who's challenging Biden in New Hampshire, he says that while Biden was the only Democrat who could beat Donald Trump in 2016, he says this year Biden is the only Democrat who can lose to Donald Trump. Ooh, that's a very frightening idea. And so we're, you know, we're, what, 60 days out from the beginning of this. And it's going to be, you know, it'll have its colorful moments and its ups and downs and the horse race and so on. But brooding over everything is what we began the program with, that Donald Trump seems to be promising and bragging about an American version of fascism in his second term.
Mm. Well, Jack, this is the point in the podcast where I usually ask you to give us a teaser for next week, but we're actually going to take a pause from the Jackpod next week, not for any other reason than it's going to be Thanksgiving. And you
we're pardoning the turkey.
And you definitely deserve a bit of rest and reflection, given how fantastic the first 11 Jackpods have been. And actually, because of that, because we're taking a Thanksgiving break, I just want to say, Jack, or share, Jack, with you, my profound gratitude to you, Jack, because we've had, a 20-year professional colleagueship. I have learned so much from you every single day of those 20 years, and being able to have these weekly conversations with you now, Jack, just it means so much to my mind and my heart. Thank you for being a friend and a key part of the On Point staff for so long.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, guys, everyone else, we wish you peace and grace over the Thanksgiving holiday. This is On Point.